Welcome to the Round 6 Podcast, a weekly roundtable discussion featuring a variety of automotive subjects, interviews, special guests, and stories, hosted by the Round 6 Gearheads, Brian Stupski, Brad King, Alex Welsh, and Eric Hibbs. On episode 11, the Gearheads sit and talk fortuitous timing, legendary influences, and the value of passion in your work with Carson Lev of Redfin Productions. Welcome to the Round 6 Podcast. I'm Brian.
I'm Brad.
I'm Alex.
I'm Eric.
And tonight we are proud to have with us a guy who, if I even tried to come up with some kind of a witty opening or anything like that, it would just be far overshadowed by his accomplishments as a mover and shaker behind the scenes in the hot rod world, Mr. Carson Lev.
Rarely, unless it's a subpoena, does it say Mr. in front of it.
Yeah. It has been kind of a long road to get you on the show. I know you're a busy man, and I truly appreciate your time being here with us tonight. It's just a shame that you missed our 10th anniversary show. It was a musical.
Was Brad dancing again?
Yes. As always. This and time, not so naked,
though. They made me wear pants this time. I was kind of...
Don't
worry
about it. It's only bad when you do the curtsy at the end.
But it's amazing how it can touch the ground. Anyway.
Yeah, the skirt, no doubt.
When that one goes live, we'll edit you in there somehow. It'll be worth it.
Pick it up in post.
Hey. Yeah, some places they have a motto that says excellence every day. Ours says, we'll fix it in post.
Exactly. Perfect.
So how are you, sir?
I'm good. Doing good. We're keeping plenty busy, lots to do, so we're having a good time.
So are you able to talk about the project you're working on presently that kind of, you know, that kept you, not to, you know, make you feel bad, but away from us?
I can tell you, for one of my clients, I'm simultaneously negotiating three aspects of his business. A return to television, a pretty significant real estate transaction, and a pretty significant licensing program that's going to be an amendment and an extension of an existing agreement. So kind of.
Wow. So how is Mr. Trump?
You took it away. I was going to go with, I cannot wait for the new Ernest Goes To series on TV.
But... Ernest goes to rehab.
Exactly. Ernest goes to the royal wedding.
Oh, even better.
Damn, how do we miss that?
Gladly is how. That's how we miss it.
Awesome. I know you've been extremely busy, and like I said, please don't apologize. You know, there's scheduling conflicts, things like that happen. So we are stoked to have you, though, because you're one of those guys that we always kind of lean on when we need advice for everything, and you're always there for us. And someday we're gonna have to send you like a gift basket or something.
Nice. I'll be looking for that.
Gift basket.
Just send a basket. I don't need the gifts.
Everybody can use a basket, right?
Exactly.
Well, speaking of baskets, this one's in some kind of a basket going somewhere. So are you able to share a little bit more about that other project you're working on?
I've got a deal I'm working on trying to get put together for PBS for a documentary on Mario Andretti. Project kind of fell on my lap. Friend of a friend, knew somebody at PBS. They're trying to extend their American Masters program. And so it's a cool story. I've known Mario since I was about 14 or 15. Did a lot of work with him at Hot Wheels and through the Diecast Hall of Fame. He's a member of that, and I was. And it's just a cool story about when he came to the United States and his whole family and what they wanted to do. And it's a story of assimilation. And, you know, he's the only guy, I think, to win Indy, Formula One, NASCAR, Daytona, Le Mans, and a couple other races. I mean, he's just a fantastic guy and has a great family history. So there's a cool story there.
Very cool.
Outstanding.
And then just the regular stuff for clients between, you know, Chip Foose and RMD Garage and West Coast Customs, Mecum Auctions. We do a lot of work for NBC Universal on Fast and Furious, continue to work with them. And then we do a lot of consulting. And I still teach at the university. I teach a medical product design class from my early career, which is kind of fun. We just had our graduation commencement on Monday, which was cool. And so I try to give back to the university that helped me get my career started. So, yeah, a lot of diversity, a lot of different things going on, but that's kind of how I like it.
Man, so what do you do with all your free time?
That's when I try to sleep. But I'm not a big sleeper. I get too wound up. I think I've said this before, but, you know, as a kid, I was probably called active, quote unquote. You know, there's probably different words for it. Now they're more clinical.
ADHD?
It might require medication. So, you know, I tend to spend at a high frequency. I like to keep busy. I don't like to sit still.
I can't, again, you know, if I try to express in words how thankful I am that you always manage to find time for us, that means everything to us.
Well, here's the deal. I'll tell you how I judge these things. I get a lot of calls to get involved in a lot of stuff. I only get involved in the stuff that really interests me or I really like the people or both. And so I like what you guys are doing and I like you guys. So you've kind of got me on the roster. Sorry, I might start calling you and just giving you advice unwarranted. So get ready.
That sounds good.
I'll take that.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Thank you again, sir.
That's my pleasure. This is fun.
We are going to need to come up with like a Carson signal from each of our houses. It'll be awesome.
Like a special phone.
A big 59 fin in the sky.
Just the red taillight with a cord.
It'll be red, you know, like the bat phone. That'll be awesome.
I like that.
The Lev phone.
Shaped like a cat eye, right?
Yeah.
Man, you are probably one of the most fascinating people that at least I know that I have in my life. So it's really tough to even start to think of where to begin with you, because your story is mind-blowingly cool. You know, I'm not trying to oversell you. It's, if anything, I'm probably underselling you with that. But I'd love to, you know, in your words, I mean, you were brought up in Southern California, right in that hotbed of hot rodding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And man, you obviously you have this weird kind of almost, and I mean this with the most respect, you have like this Forrest Gump kind of thing going about you.
Yeah.
You're always...
Somebody said that to me the other day. You're kind of like the Forrest Gump of design and automotive world. And they said, I'm sorry to say that. I said, no, I kind of like that. I try to explain to people that I have a really eclectic career and background and passion, and they all kind of come together. But really the real true story, and I don't deny this, is growing up, I had a lot of people that mentored me and looked out for me and gave me guidance. I grew up without a dad. My dad died when I was 3 and a half. I was kind of needy, you know, without really knowing it at the time. So I was always searching for, you know, kind of influence and trying to find the back way into a cool shop or racetrack or whatever. And I had a lot of guys who really, you know, back in the day were important guys, but now I realize later are really important guys, big time guys who looked out for me and mentored me and it meant a lot to me. And so, that's why I try to, you know, give back and do whatever I can now, because I realize that at any given time, we all need support. We all need help. You know, there's one small thing that somebody can say that makes the difference in your life. And I have a lot of guys who did that for me. So I was really blessed to be born when I was born in the area I was born and have friends and family that were, you know, doing cool stuff from racing to all kinds of other things.
I think in that you kind of embodied the family of hot rodding. And that's just incredible.
Yeah, I grew up in the Lakewood area, Lakewood, Long Beach. I was born in 52, so I'm an old goat. Just turned 65 last year. But when I was a kid, there was probably 16 or 17 major drag strips, just drag strips alone in Southern California, from Palmdale all the way down to San Gabriel and San Diego, Poway, Lyons, Pomona, Irwindale, OCIR, you know, just on and on and on. And so it wasn't hard to find a place to go on a weekend. Of course, I stayed close in the Long Beach area before I could drive or hitchhike or get friends to take me. But I was always either at Marine Stadium for the boat races and the ski races and the Cracker Box and the K boats and, you know, the water skiing events, all that stuff. Lions Dragstrip really was my base camp. I spent every weekend there. My mom worked on Saturdays and had to be at work at 8, so she would drop me off at 7 o'clock at the gate. The gate didn't open till 8, so I would kind of chill for an hour. That's where I first met Mickey Thompson. And I'll tell you that story in a minute. But, yeah, and then, you know, Veteran Stadium, where we used to race motorcycles and Speedway and, you know, Ascot doing TT and Hare and Hound. And just so anything with a motor and wheels just, you know, fascinated me. And I was lucky that all around me in that area were hot rod shops, you know, pinstripers, painters, fabricators, welders, drivers, engine builders, part guys, you know, from Reith Automotive to Kirby's Painting Place, you know, to Keith Black. I mean, there was, you know, Moon Eyes. There was always somewhere cool to go. It was like just a bunch of cool clubhouses that you got to hang out in.
Cool. It's amazing.
You were around everybody. That's what's so cool is like stuff I read about, but you were there.
Yeah, I mean,
in the middle of it.
I mean, the really early influences really were at Lions Drag Strip and then in the painting and customization world. I mean, I loved engines and stuff, and I loved all the chassis building and innovation, but for some reason, I had more of an art spin back days. Back in those days, I used to draw a lot. So I hung around in Ed Ross' shop for a period of time when he was in Maywood, when I could get a ride up there for a very short period of time, a little more than 2 years. Ed kind of had a guest appearance, we'll say, quote unquote, in the Lakewood area, when he kind of got kicked out of Maywood after what they called the shootout at, you know, in Maywood Bell, which was supposed to be the big attack of the Hells Angels. It's a great story. It never took place like that, that they had a machine gun on the roof of the building, and it never happened that way, but it was a great story for Ed to tell. So when he got kind of kicked out of the Maywood Bell area there, he worked out at Lakewood for a while, and I would hang out there every damn day. And he was... He was an amazing influence on me. I realize and am smart enough to know that he had his struggles and his issues. He may not have been the greatest father at the time. He had a lot of things going on. But for me, he was monumentally influential to me in my identity. And I'll just give you the psychology of it. I came from a different family. My dad died early. I was had a different name, Carson. Everybody in those days was John or Bob or Fred. My name was Carson. I was short. I was insecure. And I'd hang around a shop, and one time he kind of cajoled me into talking about myself, like, oh, just let's talk about one thing you don't like about yourself. And I'm thinking, well, I'm 12 years old. There's nothing I like about myself. Thank you. So he was putting gold leaf on the Druid Princess, if you remember with that car.
Yeah.
Coronation coach that had the basically art framing frame on the roof of it, like crown molding. And he was putting, you know, sizing on it and literally peeling off gold leaf and throwing it. Most of it was landing in the air and on the ground as he pushed it on there. And I mean, the guy was notoriously sloppy. And he said, so let's talk. You don't talk much, kid, which is different than me now. And he said, let's get into a discussion. You're way too quiet. He goes, let's do this. Tell me one thing you don't like about yourself. And like I said, there was nothing I liked. And he said, look at me. I've got a giant nose and I have huge hands. I have no fine motor skills. Everything is just, you know, this, you know, like working with gloves on. He says, so what don't you like? And I couldn't come up with anything. He said, well, I don't really like my name. Back in those days, my nickname was Corky. And almost everybody called me Corky because I hated Carson. So I told him my real name because he knew me as Corky. And he said, oh, my God. He goes, I'm going to tell you something. He goes, you need to treat that name the way I work on a car. You find the thing that you don't like the most, and you work on it so much that you end up loving it. He said, there's going to come a day that people are going to know you by your name. He said, you know, it's okay to be different. It's okay to be outside the norm. You know, I think his phrase was like normalcy is mediocrity or something like that. And he said, look at me. I'm a grown man. I draw crazy monsters and build crazy cars for a living. He said, you can't go much crazier than that. And it really honestly, at 12 years old, opened up my eyes to the concept that I didn't have to fit into a mold. And then I had a lot of other conversations with him. The highlight of my career was years later when I was at Mattel Hot Wheels, bringing him back into that company and doing products with him before he passed, which was just a nice – I have a lot of these things in my life that start at one point, and a few years later I come back to that point. And the Ed Ross story was one of them. But so, I mean, that's just an example. And then from Lions Drag Strip, meeting Mickey Thompson and C.J. Pappy Hart and, you know, Steve Evans and, you know, gosh, Wally Parks, you know, Prudhomme and McEwen, you know, later I went to work for Hot Wheels. So I was lucky to be born where I was, and I think – looking back on it, I think my insecurities drove me to just kind of reach out more than maybe the average kid. I don't know.
Right.
But I was hungry for a lot. Yeah, it was fun. Wow. I mean, it was the heyday back in those days when guys would literally build cars in their garage at night and on weekends. They all had other jobs. There was really very few professionally touring guys other than Ivo and Prudhomme, you know, the Greek maybe. You know, you didn't have, you know, corporate sponsorships. A lot of these guys were local sponsors and they did some barnstorming. But I mean, you got to remember, Ivo and Prudhomme were the first guys to really formally travel and match race across the United States and make money out of it. Then later with Hot Wheels, I mean, that deal, but really the early days, it was Ivo and Prudhomme. So, and And I had friends like the Mooneyhams who made Mooneyham blowers who had a race car, and Mooneyham and Faust and the 554 Coupe, and then Rap Rossi and Mondonello, the Purple Gang. Dunn and Reith. I used to hang out at Reith Automotive all the time, you know, and then between hanging out at Kenny Youngblood and Kirby's shop, where they called the Funny Car Factory, you know, just it was the heyday. You know, it's funny how I had no perspective out of that time, but now I look back on it and I go, wow, that was kind of interesting. It's kind of cool. So, yeah, I mean, I could go off in any tangent. Any of those things create any interest, you'll draw a story out of me on any of those guys' names or any subject matter easily. So don't get me started.
Well, that's what we're hoping to do. So, man, I mean, that is something I want to go back to all that, because that is, like I said, it's mind blowing. I mean, for me, you know, knowing that, you know, hey, you were there in this hotbed of activity with these guys whose names are basically their legend at this point. You know, how did that grooming at that point lead you to wind up at California State University at Long Beach?
You know, it's interesting because in the early days, all the car racing and building and fabricating and painting, other than the painters and the builders, the professional builders, you know, the guys who drove them and really put them together, was kind of a backyard thing. It really started getting formal. So a lot of the guys I knew in school, their dads were all racers or builders and stuff. And so the first real formal introduction was Mickey Thompson. As I mentioned, my mom worked on Saturdays. She would drop me off at the gate at Lions Drag Strip on a Saturday. It didn't matter if it was a weekend event, a big PDA event, an NHRA, AHRA. I just hung out there every Saturday. But I would sit out there for an hour until the gates opened. And, you know, that's when Mickey Thompson was the track manager. And, yeah, after seeing me 2-3 times in a row, he came up and he always had either Lincoln Continentals or big Buicks, because he was sponsored back in those days. He put his window down. He said, "Kid, what are you doing? I see you're here every Saturday." And I said, "Well, my mom works Saturday. She drops me off." He goes, "Well, you're sitting out here waiting for the gates to open." I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, you know, come on, jump in the car and I'll give you a ride in." So he drove me in, you know, "What's your name? Where do you live? Who are your friends?" And, you know, I'm talking to this guy. And I know it's Mickey Thompson, but here's the funny thing. I didn't want to act like, "Oh, it's Mickey Thompson," but I knew who the guy was.
Sure.
And Mickey was a tough guy. Let me tell you, Mickey, I'd seen him, you know, getting arguments with guys, and he wasn't shy about expressing himself with a quick jab to the nose. I mean, he was kind of a roustabout. You know, he didn't take any, you know what.
That's funny. I never knew that about him. That's funny.
Yeah, he didn't really, you know, put up with much. I mean, he had long tolerance, but once he was done, he was done. So anyway, so he said, "Well, if you're going to be here every Saturday, I need somebody who will wash my cars and get my stuff ready. I have a Kwanzaa hut right across the street where if there's a problem with the car, they can come over here and weld it. There's a bit of a fixture like for chassis rails, that if a guy bends a chassis rail, we can straighten stuff out. I got a machine back in the back to, you know, clean parts up and stuff." So he says, "A lot of guys go across the street. So, you know, tell you what, instead of your mom dropping you off at the gate, have her drop you off here. I'll leave one of my cars out on a Friday night. It'll be there. The bucket will be here. And now here's a simplistic thing of it, too." He was the first guy who taught me how to wash a car. I mean, okay. Like the practicality of washing a car. He says, "Look, you always rinse it off first. You get the whole car wet. You make sure it stays wet. You start at the top. You use a clean sponge every time. You need to clean that sponge. You don't use the same sponge for the he had vinyl tops. You don't use the same one for the vinyl top and the paint that you do for the wheels. That's a different one. Use a different brush to scrub the tires. You never contaminate those two. If you drop a sponge on the ground, throw it in the trash and get a new one. They're over here. Start from the top, work your way down, do this, dry it this way. Here's how you use a chamois. Here's how you wring it out. Here's how it just," he taught me the practical aspect of washing a car. To this day, I still wash a car the Mickey Thompson way.
Think about how cool Mickey Thompson taught you how to wash a car.
Here's how dumb I was.
You need to start marketing those classes. Wash your car the Mickey Thompson way.
I didn't know there was a special way to wash a car. I thought you got it wet, you put soap on it, you rinsed it off, and that was it. But all these little nuances. So I would go over there. My mom would drop me off, and sure enough, the hose would be rolled up on the side of the building. I'd squirt the car down, and I'd do the whole thing and get it done. He'd come by 8:15, pick me up. And the deal used to be that I would wash either one of two of his cars, and he would give me $5, get me into the drags for free, and quote-unquote, buy me a hamburger. It wasn't until years later, Colleen Thompson Camp, who's his sister and a wonderful lady, when I was in Park and Rec Commission in our city for 10 years, she was the mayor of San Juan Capistrano. We did a lot of joint efforts together. She laughed when I told her that Mickey bought me lunch. She said, "Stop. Mickey never bought anybody lunch." She said, "At that time, he was the track manager. Let me guess. He he walked you over to the concession stand and said, give this kid a burger. And I said, yeah. She goes, okay, that's not him buying you lunch. he ran the track. They did what he told him to. So it's kind of fun.
She but stole he, your thunder.
Yeah. But she really, he really got me started on the passion side and was the first to kind of give me a practical lesson on how to do things. Because you got to remember back in those days, and Brad will know this from pinstriping, the other guys will know this from graphics. Back in the, Brad's not as old as me, but in the earlier days, no one shared trade secrets. Nobody told you how to do things. You either signed up to be an apprentice and you gave your time for free to learn whatever it was, you know, milling and porting an engine, how to adjust fuel injection, how to time a motor, how to grind a cam. You didn't just walk into a guy's shop and say, hey, teach me how to pinstripe. And so he was my
and
first.
And pay me $15 an hour.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I want vacation retirement. Like today. But he was the first guy who kind of took me under his wing and kind of tutored me and mentored me. And through watching Mickey and how he carried himself, how he took care of problems, like I said, he had a he really was very patient. But once he knew it was going to go to no means to an end, then he put an end to it. And he put an end to it in various ways. He just – I thought that negotiation tactic was beautiful. It was simple. You know, I'll work with you. I'll listen to you. As long as you have a valid argument, we'll stand here and we'll talk. We may shout. We may yell. But the minute it becomes an impasse and I realize you're either just a knucklehead or you just want to argue and yell, I'm either going to walk away or I'm going to punch you in the nose. And I thought, that's kind of a good way to go through life. I mean, I didn't have any other role models, so I thought that one looked pretty good.
That's pretty good. I'm just hurt by the whole Mickey thing. You go, wow, Mickey Thompson's one of the first. Here's a guy that's kind of helping, besides Ed Roth. You go, really? Seriously?
Yeah. And early on, I would probably say, and really when you think about those two personalities that couldn't have been more diametrically opposed, Mickey, a businessman, an innovator, a manager, a creator and innovator, in a business sense and in a racing sense, Ed, in many of those things, a creator and an innovator in an artistic and design sense, Mickey was really not a real polished guy, not a three-piece suit kind of guy, but Mickey could, you know, spiff up and clean up pretty well, and he had a business sense to him. Ed was the guy always in overalls with, you know, yesterday's food still on the front of him, you know? So, you know.
Well, I got a question for you. In your business that you've gone on and done, was any of that guided from what Mickey taught you? I mean, did he teach you any business specifics that you went, I'm going to do things this way because that's how he taught you?
Yeah,
or was he an influence that way at all?
It's funny. It's funny for me years later, I didn't realize now until I really start dissecting why I feel and think and have certain ideas about business and licensing negotiations that I don't realize until later that a lot of that was influenced. And so, you know, a lot of times I watched Mickey negotiate something where a guy thought he was in the wrong class. He should have been moved up to a different index, or he wanted the handicap system to work on a delay start where they handicapped the two cars differently, or he felt right. that he didn't pass tech or safety, or the car wasn't legit, or the driver wasn't certified. And I would, you know, I shadowed Mickey a lot, just walked around, and he kind of let me, you know, he never really invited me to, I just kind of did it. But the way, I guess I'd learned from him, the way he kind of had a no-nonsense, very easy-to-discern way of solving problems. And it didn't take you long to figure out he was going to solve the problem or he's going to walk away or he's going to punch you in the nose. And I thought, in simplistic forms, that made sense to me because we all get convoluted up in process and emotional aspects of arguments and the linearity and the mechanics of an argument. And you can find yourself going down the rabbit hole. And this is a bad thing to say. I hope my wife's not listening. But sometimes, like in the old days, when I got in an argument with my wife, and I had to stop and think, okay, now why am I mad? What started this argument? Do I really have a point here, or am I just arguing for the sake of argument?
Right.
And sometimes people do that. Mickey, God love him, had no patience for that because he was busy. you got to remember, he's building cars. He's got corporate sponsorships. He's managing a racetrack. He's got sponsorships from Pontiac, from Ford, from all kinds of people, all kinds of things pulling on him. So he had to be a really efficient guy. So yeah, I would say that approach did influence me. And then Ed influenced me on the creative side. So it's funny, you asked how I ended up at Long Beach, and it's kind of a convoluted story, but my family doctor had a Dino, and he's the guy who brought me into the world. And I thought that Dino was the most amazing, still do. I still think it's absolutely one of the most beautiful cars in the world. His was a 66 or a 67. And I just, and I loved the whole, you know, the whole aspect of that car that you weren't supposed to call it a Dino Ferrari. It's a Dino, which is separate than Ferrari.
Right.
Anyway, the proper guys always correct you when you say Dino Ferrari, you know. Anyway, I thought to get a Dino or to get a Ferrari, I needed to be a doctor. So I started out early on, as much as I was doing pinstriping graphics and lettering, I was in a pre-med course and, you know, kinesthetics, biochem, all that stuff, thinking I'm going to go to med school. And applied and went on rounds with my family doctor. I went to see him for I was on a gymnastics scholarship, and I went to see my doctor, and he to get this thing fixed. He said, what are you doing? I told him, he said, oh, you're making a big mistake. And anyway, long story short, I went on rounds with him and realized that job sucked. It was not what I thought it was. And so I ended up getting a degree in biomedical product development. But before I was at Long Beach State, I of course was into cars and drawing and, hanging out with all my buddies and going to the racetracks and stuff. And that was really my passion. But I had the understanding that that passion would never be a business, that that passion would never equate to an income. So because of my doctor and the Dino, I thought medicine. And I really got into gymnastics. My brother was 3 years older than me. My next older brother, he was a gymnast. I was, like I said, I was a little guy. I was short. And I got into gymnastics in fourth grade. And so I had like a 3-year head start for anybody who even showed up at junior high and did pretty well. And in high school, we won CIF. And I, you know, was like sixth in the state in individuals, did good. I got a lot of scholarship offers. So it was either going to be USC, LSU, or Long Beach. Well, there was a girl I met in high school who I thought was pretty cool, so I was going to stay close to Long Beach because that's where she was going. Thank God, like 48 years later, that lady's still with me, thank God. Even after tricking her and making her think I might have, could have possibly been a doctor, but she doesn't hold that against me. And so I ended up at Long Beach, and being at Long Beach was a godsend too. You know, the education I got there, more context, I got to stay in the local circle and still, you know, do all the stuff and hang around with my buddies, so I didn't have to travel out of state. And so I ended up at Long Beach, and it's interesting because I started off with bio, pre-med and biology and all that. After coming back, after my doctor basically said, hey, you probably shouldn't pursue a career in medicine, I went back and got an aptitude test, and they discovered that I'm right brain, left brain. She laughed as she walked down the hall looking at me like I've never had one of these. 49,
51. A brain?
Right? Exactly. You're linear and lateral. You're engineering and you're art. And so she said, we have this program called industrial design. Let's go down and see if they'll accept you in the program. Do you have a portfolio? And I said, what is a portfolio? I had no idea. We had sketches and drawings. I said, well, I have some little Kodak pictures of models I've built and lettering and signs and graphics and stuff I've done painting on. And I have these sketches in this book. Took it down there and they accepted me in the industrial design program. With the caveat that my senior thesis, which would be additional to my studies, because they accepted me as a junior, which I was at the time, biology, they accepted me as a junior. They basically said, you'll do a senior thesis in medical product design, but you will get no units for it. You'll get no credit for it. It's just going to be an extra class. So I got through, did my senior thesis in medical product design. I was hired before I graduated working in medical products.
Awesome.
So that was fun, but I was really this weird right brain, left brain. So I would be designing medical equipment and medical, CT scanners and MRI and stuff during the day. And at night I'd go letter a boat or a race truck or a car or a Baja, off-road truck or a motorcycle or, sandblasted redwood signs in my garage. So it was kind of like, being a plumber and being a nuclear scientist at the same time. It was like one was one end and one was the other, but I found it really helped me emotionally because mentally, medical products take a long time to bring to the market. I needed to be able to load up, put it on a panel, pull it and see what I got.
Right.
Well, yeah, it was fun. And, I still do, a fair share of lettering and graphics, and I paint a lot of stuff and I give a lot of stuff away.
And I've seen some of your work, and your striping and brushwork is absolutely amazing.
Thanks.
And, well, after you give me something, I think you should start selling them because I think, you can probably make some money doing that.
What I do a lot of times is I trade with people. So I'll do something for them and they'll do something for me. So I kind of,
he still begs on me. He's still waiting for his clock. So I.
Yeah. I got something for you. Although I did do one for Jeff Styles. And I'm still waiting for my bomb. Jeff's supposed to give me a bomb. I did a skateboard. with my version of Lady Luck, Jeff likes to paint the Lady Luck, the girl with the eight balls
yep.
and right.
stuff. And I did my version of that one, a little more provocative version. all I'll say is when my wife saw it, she said, "You're not hanging that in your room."
No, I'm not. Nope, that goes in the living room, dear.
It's going over the fireplace. But yeah, I get a lot of enjoyment out of the lettering, and that goes to another story, and that's Kenny Youngblood, who was, you know, one of the premier painters, you know, airbrushers of grills and funny cars, and he was at Kirby's Place in Bellflower when I was in junior high. And that's when I was in the heyday of going to the drags, and I used to ride my bike or hitchhike down there and hang out at Kirby's. And Kenny was, I mean, I tell the same dumb story, but it, I can remember like yesterday. I watched him over 3 days lay out and letter the Barry Setzer Vega funny car. I watched him take a Stabilo pencil and a yardstick and draw letters in, you know, no projector, no nothing. Kenny was a phenomenal artist. Laid it out, did the background colors, you know, the kind of imitation gold color on the background. Immediately airbrushed, you know, an orange fade up the back and some white highlights on it, and let that dry. Next day came back and black outlined it, worked his way around the rest of the car, did all the sponsor names and the logos, came back in and put it all together. And the way Kirby's was set up on Clark and Bellflower, they were kind of like big open buildings, but at the back was a passageway that connected multiple buildings. So Kirby did the fiberglass molds and did the painting, and then Youngblood had like a little section, like a little garage with a roll-up door in front or a tilt-up door in front that he did the lettering. And Kenny was notorious, and we all knew this, that when he started lettering a car, that garage door went down and no one was allowed to watch. It was funny, as good as he is, he was a little insecure. And he didn't like people watching him. So I stood at the back in the doorway for 3 days, not 3 days straight, but like 2-3 hours a day in the afternoon after school, and watched him letter that and just took mental notes like, oh my God, this is a wet on wet technique where he airbrushes. Now I know why, because now the paint sticks. Oh, look, he doesn't outline it until that's dry. He puts the highlights in now. He does this. He draws a line this way. I mean, I watched every technique. And on the third day, as he's putting the final touches on the Barry Setzer Vega funny car, without even looking over his shoulder, he says, "You know, kid, you could stand there for day after day and look over my shoulder, or you can pick up a brush and learn something." Oh, and I'm like, he knows I'm here. And he goes, "You know," he didn't use the word stealth, but he said something like, "You know, you're not invisible. You know, I've seen you from the beginning. I know who you are, you know." And so he said, "You know, go get a National Dragster over there on my workbench. Go to the back where all the logos are. Grab that panel," which was like a piece of a busted up race car. "Get a Stabilo pencil." Had no idea what a Stabilo pencil was. "It said, do a layout, paint these logos. Do the STP, do the Torco motor oil. And I think the other one was like B&M, which were big B&M letters and a little cartoony guy." So I find out what a Stabilo pencil is. I'm amazed that you can draw with a pencil and erase it with water. I'm like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. You know? I've never seen anything like this, you know?
And I'm so, using this for my homework.
Yeah, exactly. So I lay it all out and I get it all, what I think is done. He said, "Dude, are you going to draw it or are you going to paint it? I didn't tell you to draw it. I said to paint it," which meant just give some rough ideas and you let your brush do the work. So then I don't know how to load a brush. I don't know how to hold a brush. I don't know how to pull a brush. I'm actually doing like a Monet stipple pattern almost instead of pulling the brush down. You know? So he stops. He says, "Okay, look, it's about lunchtime. Here's $5. Go across the street. There was a Charburger, Douglas Charburger place across. Get us a couple burgers. I'll be done. I'll give you a lesson." So I went, holy crap. So went across the street, brought back the burgers. He was done, but I was mad because I didn't get to see the final touches. And then he walked me through like, "Hey, here's how you pull a line. Here's how you load a brush. Here's how you know when you palette it right. Here's what you look for. Make sure you use a chisel this way. Make sure you flatten it. If you have to use your fingers, you know, put this down. Use a mall stick or a bridge. I don't use a mall stick. I use my arm as a bridge. So that's why I've never used a mall stick, because Kenny didn't." And then I watched him airbrush, you know, grills using an Afro pick to shoot through for the headlights. tape down for the grill and pulled it back. It was like watching magic. And so I got about 5 or 6 good lessons out of him in between my schedule when I could get down there. And I came back about a week and a half later, and he was gone, and all his stuff was gone. And I said to my buddy there, a friend of mine in high school, worked making $2 an hour sanding down fiberglass bodies. Terrible job, because it goes everywhere, the fiberglass. We should have just called him Itchy or Scratchy, because that guy was awful. Bad job. That's my kids. I said, "Where's Kenny?" He said, "Oh, he moved up to Big Bear. He's going to open a gallery up there." I went home and cried. I'm like, dude, this is all I ever wanted to do, was just letter race cars. The guy who was teaching me is now gone. And so I saw him in a few other races and saw him at some places. And it wasn't till really 20 years later that I saw him at SEMA and reconnected with him. And told him, you know, look, I don't know if you remember me. And he goes, oh, I remember you. And I said, really? He goes, yeah. And he used my nickname, Corky, which very few people called me anymore, but did then. He said, yeah, you're Corky. Yeah, I tried to give you some lettering lessons. I said, well, I've been doing this and working in this field and doing these things. I said, I probably should write you a commission check. So he said, well, yeah, you were only a handful of guys who were patient enough to hang around and wait for me to be ready to talk to you. And I didn't realize that my insecurity and my lack of talking, he took as being polite and being respectful. So, and then I said, yes, you know, so my handicap served me well.
So did you ever tell him the truth?
Kenny, in fact, I just talked to Kenny yesterday. You know what project he's working on? Down at Price Transfer down in Long Beach, by Southeast Studios. They are recreating Lion's Drag Strip.
Oh, in full scale,
with the bridge, the tower, everything. He's working on that.
Whoa. Oh, how cool.
He invited me and Chip to come down to watch him and see what they're doing, so we're going to go down. That's the guy who has all the willies and all the cars.
Yes, I've been there. That place is, yeah, Rick's Urbana. Got an amazing place.
Yeah. So Kenny's been a great friend and a great influence. He had done a lot of work for Mattel Hot Wheels, and when I was just going out on my own with Redfin, I was able to kind of regain some of Kenny's rights in licensing work that he had done that they insisted was work for hire, and I insisted was specific intellectual property. It was funny, having worked there and having run licensing, to come back and basically stage an argument against them using their own language. It was kind of fun. Basically, Kenny had done a bunch of graphics for Hot Wheels, and they wanted to act like they could use it forever. And I'm like, no, it doesn't work that way in the industry.
So do you represent Kenny? Is that another guy that you kind
of? I don't represent him. I give him a lot of counsel. I help him out on agreements. I look at certain things, and I look out for his best interests. I don't collect a dime from him. I will never collect a dime from that guy, because I could not repay him from the skill set that he taught me, the patience he showed me, and the money that I made in graphics and sign painting because of him.
That's awesome.
I'd like to pitch a short film idea based on that whole thing. A story about a kid who packs a small lunch. You know, he's got a couple of sandwiches with him. Covers himself with a tarp and hides in a corner of that shop for 3 days solid.
The other thing about Kirby's Place is literally it was the clubhouse. It was the place. That, Reith Automotive, were really the drag racing meccas. Maybe Keith Black's. Service Center was really more street racers and performance guys where they went to get their work done. But between Kirby's, Keith Black's shop in Bellflower, and Reith Automotive down on Cherry Street in Long Beach, all of those within easy reach of a bike ride for me, that was really where it was going on. I mean, I walked in and it was amazing. So, you know, like the first time I went to see Ed Roth when he was still painting with Von Dutch and Baron and Kirby. Well, they were in Bellflower. The first day I went there, what's his name? Bobby Darin was there getting a car customized and pinstriped.
Nope.
The next day I went back, it was packed with Hell's Angels. The third day I went back, Hunter S. Thompson was there. I'm like, dude.
Oh, dude.
I got to come back tomorrow to see who's here next. I mean, it was the hot rod version of the Ed Sullivan Show, because everybody was famous was in that lot.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Hell's Angels and Hunter S. Thompson, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
And Bobby Darin.
And Bobby Darin.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was blessed to be grown up in that area, to have quick and easy access to that stuff and be hungry for the attention and want to learn more. And you know, for me, it was pretty special. I mean, it's created a deep, you know, love and passion for that. But it really, I learned so many lessons from these guys that, you know, I was mentored and nurtured by these guys and given guidance. And, you know, there were a couple of times when I screwed up and they weren't afraid to grab me by the scruff of the neck and say, don't do that. There's a famous story about me on the starting line when I first met Wally Parks, because I was screwing up and he if you remember the history of Lions Drag Strip, there was a period of years there that they were on the NHRA bad list. They were not an NHRA track. They were PDA and they were AHRA. And they had a falling out during the fuel ban that NHRA had when they, you know, after John Mulligan and a lot of other guys were killed in fires, car fires, NHRA put a ban on fuel. And for a number of years, fuel was not allowed in, but at Lions, it was an independent drag strip. And so my buddy's dad ran a car there, the Purple Gang, which was, you know, the Rossi, Paul Rossi was his name, went to high school with him. His dad was Vince Rossi, who had the Vel Parnelli Jones, the Purple Gang, the Leeson Rossi wedge car, lot of really beautiful cars. And then I went to church with the Mooneyham. So I was at the drags all the time. Anyway, I'd worked my way up from the guy who got burgers in the pits to the guy who carried a rag in his back pocket to a guy who actually, after the burnout, was allowed to go up to the car. And if there's any oil coming out of the breather, to wipe it down and not get that rag caught in the blower belt and not be embarrassed by letting the rag get caught in the exhaust and have it blow out of your hand, which took months of learning to accomplish that. So, but I was such a freaking grommet at the time that I literally watched all the other guys on the cruise of which pocket they put the rag in, how far they tucked it in. Did they pull it out with their right hand or their left hand? Did they rest their hand on the Enderle injector when they wiped it down, or did they rest their hand on the valve cover? I mean, I studied these guys like science, and I got my actions down, and I'm so damn proud of myself. It's my first time. It's like 5:30 in the afternoon on a Saturday night. You know, at Lions, the air started to get cool. The track's still warm. We know it's going to be a good run. So the car does a burnout, and, you know, they push it back. And that's in those days, they used to do two and three burnouts, believe it or not just one. And they sometimes would dry hop the car to seat the clutch. More funny car guys dry hopped it than the dragster guys. Anyway, so it finally comes back, and I get the nod to go up there and, you know, check and see if there's any oil. And I go up there and I look, and I, you know, I rest my hand in the right place, and I wipe down a little bit of oil, and I put the rag back in my pocket. And it was Gary Gablish driving the car, who also was a just phenomenal guy to me. Just a gracious, gracious guy. And here's another point of connection. My sister-in-law, my wife's sister, used to work with Ray Gablish in Long Beach when she was the mayor. And so we get together and tell great Gary Gablish stories. Anyway, so the car launches and I go to run, you know, get on the return road, get in the station wagon. And this giant person grabs me by the arm and says, "Kid, what are you doing up here?" And I'm like, well, I'm with these guys, and they're literally going to the car and they're driving away. And I'm, you know what? They don't wait. You know, they go. So he's got me by the arm. He goes, "What are you doing?" He goes, "How old are you?" I said, I'm 15. He said, "You can't be on the starting line unless you're 18 years old." He goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm with those guys." He goes, "Who?" I go, "Well, they're going down the return road." He goes, "What team are you with?" Then Pappy Hart came by. Pappy was always on that little Honda 90. You know, he always had a little fisherman hat. He goes, "You know, Wally, it's okay. It's okay. He's good. He's good with me." So Wally walks away, and then Pappy pulls me aside. He goes, "Do you know who that was?" I said, "I have no idea." He says, "What did he say to you?" I said, "He asked who I was." He goes, "Well, that's Wally Parks." He said, "Shit, kid, you might have screwed it up for me. I'm trying to get back to the NHRA." So my introduction to Wally Parks.
The guy who ruined Lions Dragster for the NHRA.
Yeah, exactly. They never got certified again. But it was funny, years later when I was at Mattel and we did more work with Hot Wheels and I saw Wally and became good friends with him, I kicked myself in the butt because I didn't know this was what Wally did. But almost every time I would see him at SEMA or at the races or at the NHRA, he'd write me a little note. Like, "Hey, it's good to see you. Remember next time when you're thanking people that it's the people who did the safety crew who did this." Or remember next time, he would always write me little notes. And damn, I didn't keep them. And now I've realized that there are guys who kept those notes from Wally. Of advice, you know, what to do, how to handle yourself at a drag strip, you know, notes to John Force in the early days about perseverance and
which and, pocket to put the rag in and how
deep, how far to hang out. Exactly. But yeah, I tell him that story and he says, "Well, that sounds like something I would have said to you." You know, I was worried about safety at the time. And so, you know, when I was at Hot Wheels and Wally turned 90, we did a special car for him and we did the banquet for him at the
right
museum. And, you know, he was another guy who really was very influential. You know, I was lucky that I just happened to be at the right spot.
Did you get to tell that story doing an introduction for him at all?
I think I did mention that the first time I met Wally was because he thought I was screwing up, and I probably was. Yes. I mean, sorry to take you down the rabbit hole, but I mean, to me, I'm fortunate that almost all these guys they all do. They're all significant in different ways of either, you know, challenging me, giving me opportunity, giving me guidance, mentoring me, giving me, you know, good advice, telling me what I needed to know instead of what I, you know, felt like I wanted to know. I mean, I was very, very blessed.
That's cool.
Okay. Now back to the beginning here, when you were doing the, your medical stuff and you got into that, and we had talked about that before, and you had a couple of patents correct there.
I had worked early on in, because I had the, biomed background. When I did my senior thesis, I did it on medical products and medical design, and really not that I was any break frame guy, but I was one of the first guys to understand that understanding human factors, which means the scale of people, how long their limbs are, body mass, and how that relates to being able to get a good diagnostic result, meaning an X-ray, a CT, an MRI, that if you do good patient handling and the patient is comfortable, you'll get better results. But if the patient is uncomfortable or stressed because of your machine and they're fidgeting around, you're constantly rescanning. So it's like taking an X-ray. If the kid's not calm and you're trying to figure out it's a broken bone, he's moving around, you never get a clear radiograph. So right. I focused on human factors, and human factors is a study of the body as it relates to design and linking and how a person fits in a car to equipment to all this stuff. It was really started by a designer called Henry Dreyfuss, who was a real famous industrial designer. Anyway, I applied it to the medical field, feeling that the medical field never understood this. And it became a key to my career. So I worked a lot on patient handling and comfort and controls and basically developing a menu-based system so you don't have a control panel of a machine that looks like Three Mile Island, that you have a menu-driven system that shows you what you should be doing within the variables that are available within that subset of instructions. In other words, you would never take an instruction sheet for building something from IKEA and have not 30 steps, but one step that included 30 subsets. You just don't do that. But medicine was so profoundly worried about getting good results that they didn't worry about patients so much. Sad. And so I did that senior thesis. I got hired on the night of a senior presentation before I was even graduated, and I worked for the company that was really the first company to make a dedicated CT head scanner. And we were a little tiny company that just had rocket fuel underneath us. We ended up being the biggest company. We ended up buying the company that started CT scanning, and then I ended up working for the guy indirectly, but I sat in meetings with him and took direction from him, the guy who won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 1974, a guy named Dr. Godfrey Hounsfield. And this was 77, so he took an idea and turned it into equipment. And so, yeah, when you look at how a CT scanner rotates and how it moves around and how the X-ray tube is on one half of a circle and the receptors are on the other, it kind of predicates how big the aperture, the opening, will be for the person to fit through. And you have, you know, human scale and human factors, and you know how big people can be. And, you know, 200, 300 pounds, you still want to put them through there. So it dictated how big the aperture or where you would go through in this tunnel. Well, the machine kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I said, guys, you know, if you ever think about spin a quarter, how it kind of wobbles off angle, if we offset that circular device and not have it run 90 degrees to the floor or to the plane, but runs at an angle, I can reduce the overall height. And the benefit of that is that as this X-ray tube scans across the body, it doesn't scan straight down, it scans at an angle. We know the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. On that angle, I pick up more data, and I do it in a more compact way. The term is called nutation. The person on the patent that's included on that with me is a guy named Chuck McGregor. I worked with Chuck. But that was kind of a fun thing. And then there was also operating things, operating efficiencies, cam levers, activations. I was very lucky back in those days. When you did something inventive, the company patented it for you in your name. They didn't take ownership. It was a way to attract designers into the work
field. No kidding.
Now when you go to work for anybody, they say, we own all your designs outright, even if you come up with it in your sleep, even if you work for me building submarines, if you come up with a better cookie mix, we own that too. And so I was very lucky that I had some technology grants. I have some grants in blood handling, blood filtration, and oxygenators and blood reservoirs that are called cardiotomies. It's interesting that equipment that I designed and worked on was used in my grandson's open heart surgery, which was another one of those things where you start here and you come back around and you're back where you started.
That's wow. Wow.
That's amazing. Full circle, huh?
But then also I consider that the glory days of medical product design, because it wasn't unusual when I worked at Pfizer in the blood handling group to get a call from a doctor saying, hey Carson, I'm going to be doing some clinical trials in this blood reservoir. Can you come down to the hospital and, you know, stand next to me and show me the operational procedures? And I'd be standing right next to him as they use this equipment and fine-tuning it and giving him advice. And then the doctor would say, gosh, you know, I'm making an entry here on the left side of this ventricle. If I had a forcep that would expand and go this, I could contract this vessel at the same time. I go, well, wait, we can build that. I'd go back to my designers, my labs, we'd sketch something up, and we had a full prototyping machine shop. We were the first truly paperless CAD-based medical product design company in the world. at Pfizer. We had the number four rapid prototype machine ever built. So we could design something on a computer, build it in a 3D printer, and have a prototype in 2 or 3 days to look at. We could streamline it. So back in those days, I would be in surgeries, and the doctors would say, you know, I thought about this. Could you make a machine that would do this? Sure.
And have it done before the operation was over. Nice.
We had some things that really were pretty amazing. I'd worked with a guy on a unit that's called an ECMO unit. And ECMO just means extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. All it means is you oxygenate the blood outside of the body, outside the corpuscles. And we had that in clinical trials. And this was years ago. There was a kid in Chicago during the winter who was a freshwater drowning accident victim, was underwater for 45 minutes and was clinically dead. And they called us, and they called the doctor who was the lead designer on the project. And I was an industrial designer, product designer, mechanical engineer on. They said, look, we've got a kid here at Southern Illinois Hospital who's a freshwater drowning. You've got your equipment, you know, 60 miles away in clinical trials. Will you break the trial, break the seal, so we can try that machine on this kid? We think it'll work. And we said, yeah. Well, clinical trial is just that. It's a trial. You go into a room. You go in with a procedure. You cannot vary from that procedure, even if you find the greatest answer in the world. You have to be in lockdown because it's science. It's like a control group when you do a hypothesis. And so we said, look, we'll do it. The kid was brought back to life, and he's a fully healthy kid now. He's probably 50 years old. And what they did is, what this thing did was slowly take the blood out of his body, outside of his body, heat it, warm it up slowly, little by little by little, because when you lose temperature and you drop, it goes through a cascading effect, and your body starts literally closing off veins, arteries, corpuscles, and capillaries, and it shuts it down, and it goes only to the very end as it shut off blood supply to your brain. Everything else shuts down before. That's why people lose limbs and fingers and stuff during frostbite. Your body shuts down. So anyway, right. We slowly brought the temperature back up. It was all done under the lead of this one doctor, and he wrote the protocol, and the kid, over a period of hours, was brought back to life. Now, he wasn't clinically dead. He was kind of, you know, by monitoring, he was dead, but he wasn't clinically dead. But he was going to die. And that was pretty amazing. That unit gets used a lot in military applications and a lot of, you know, situations. So that was kind of a fun one. So yeah, I loved medicine. I mean, actually, it was probably better for me to be a medical product designer than it would have been to be a doctor, because I got to do more stuff, but I got to have a regular life too, have kids and coach them and go on vacation and have a wife and a family.
And doctors really don't make that much money.
Not anymore.
No.
Well, not you know, Dino money.
Okay, so what was the next transition? I mean, obviously, we ended up in Hot Wheels, so...
Yeah, and that's, you know, this gets kind of this weird, crazy path. So I spent about 20 years, 17, 18, 20 years in medical product design, from CT scanners to heart bypass, thoracic surgery, trach tubes, blood filtration, ultrasound. And then around 1995, our wonderful government, like they've done before, decided we need to deregulate medical products. And the way they're put into the clinical trial system with the FDA. What had happened is it was a period of great consolidation of medical companies. So Merck and other pharmaceutical companies came together, and Johnson & Johnson merged with another company. So companies that were used to be U.S.-based, and basically 80% of their work in the U.S., now became multinational companies. And they went to the FDA and said, look, this is Pfizer, this is Johnson & Johnson, this is Gish Pharmaceuticals, this is Edwards Lifescience, Baxter's. They went to the FDA and said, look, we represent now a multinational, international approach to medicine. We would love to have the same place in line in clinical trials if we do a clinical trial in the U.S. or if we do it in Belgium or Scotland or Norway, because we will bring benefit to the U.S. Our FDA said, oh, that makes sense. Better products, faster development. This makes sense. Well, when I was in the Irvine area working at Pfizer at the time, there were 22 major medical manufacturers and distributors in the Irvine area. After this deregulation took place 3 years later, there was three of them left. All wow. development now went offshore. Why? Because it's cheaper. And so we, in the interest of better medicine, chased it offshore. Now, here's the backlash today. Pfizer then came to me and said, look, you manage the product development for four divisions for us. We are going to get out of products, mechanical products, and we're going to return to pharmacological business because we have two drugs we're working on. One of them was Procardia, heart medicine. The other one was Viagra. And they discovered that it's cheaper to do what I call cake mix, you know, put stuff together in a compound like a medicine, than it is to make a device and cut somebody open and put it in them. And there's less issues if something goes wrong. The returns are longer. The patents are longer. There's 17 years on those patents. And so they said, we're going to get out of mechanical and hard parts. Take those four divisions, turn them into four companies, get the right designers, the right engineers, the right marketing guys. You and one other guy are going to lead this project, turn them into four companies, and sell them. So I worked with investment companies like Deloitte and Touche and the big, you know, big eight finance companies and put these things together, did prospectus, learned a lot about finance, put it all together, sold the companies. And then at the end of it, they said, okay, you're not out of a job. You get to choose because all four of those companies loved you. Where do you want to work? And I said, well, the one that got sold stayed in the Irvine area. That's Mallinckrodt. They were based out of St. Louis. I just bought a big house down in Laguna Niguel. I'm going to stay here. So I worked for Mallinckrodt for about 2 years in the medical field, and they were doing mostly respiratory and trach tubes. I had done a presentation at a medical design and manufacturing show about how computers can accelerate product development, meaning if you have solid modeling, you have rapid prototyping, you have an environment that's called concurrent engineering, which simply means instead of doing a design, throwing it over the fence to the engineer, he throws it over the fence to manufacturing, they throw it over the fence to sales, you do it all together inclusively, which was a new way of doing things. I did a presentation on this and how we had found it streamlined the process. At the end of that, I had two people come up to me. One guy from the Navy, from the U.S. Navy, who said, we're studying the same thing so we can make battleships smaller and have less people and build products quicker. So instead of having 14 impeller tubes, impeller blades for a torpedo, we'll have a machine that can make them and just stock raw material. And the second group was an investment venture capital group out of Indiana that said, we would like to fund you to build businesses that do this, to do a business that does this technology. So we started a company called Compression Engineering. At the height, we had six locations. I learned all about venture capital, finance, boardroom, drama, all the nonsense, about building a business, about funding, about hiring, firing, human factors and human relations and everything. And 6 months later was the dot-com crash. I had been on these technical reviews about equipment with these big eight, you know, financial companies trying to figure out how this thing works and what the advantage is to business and like a technical thing, like how does it work? Not on the finance side, not on the investing side. And they were monthly roundtable calls with other bankers and investors about learning what's going on in the business from a technical side. So I quit doing the phone calls and they called me back. I said, well, why aren't you on these phone calls anymore? I said, well, I don't work there anymore. And they said, well, no, we want to have you now on the financial side. I go, I don't have any finance. I'm not a CPA. I'm not a financial guy. I don't work in those algorithms. They go, well, you knew enough to get out 6 months before the dot-com crash. So I said, well, here's God's truth. And this is the truth. I woke up one morning at 3 a.m. in a cold sweat, popped out of bed. My wife said, oh my gosh, are you having a nightmare? I said, I'm going to quit my job. I'm selling my shares. And she's like, well, you know, here's this poor lady who, when she first married me, was going to be married to a doctor. And then, you know, medical field for a while, then I start this startup, and God bless her. She said, no, you're having a nightmare. Go back to sleep. And I said, no, this whole thing is hanging over my head. And so that's what happened. I decided I'm going to get out of it. Well, 6 months later, the whole thing came crashing down. And really, it wasn't intuition. It wasn't understanding financial algorithms or gross national product versus consumption of oil versus the index of capital spending on computers or what blah, 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 or whatever formula I had. It was pure fear. It was just plain out fear. So my largest client at that time was Mattel Toys. I worked with a guy named Gene Inslee, who also has been a wonderful mentor to me. Gene ran worldwide engineering. He found out I left. He called me and said, what are you doing? I said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be an early retiree. You know, I could retire now, I guess, you know, but I don't know. And he says, well, come have lunch with me. So we went and had lunch, and he asked what I wanted to do. And I said, I just want to have fun. You know, I worked in this medical field, which really wasn't fun. It was intriguing. It was challenging. It's invigorating. It's rewarding, but it's not fun. I worked in technology, which was just opening a whole new world to, you know, how finance really works, you know, and kind of the ins and outs and that, and, you know, how to start a business. And I learned a lot, but I said, I want to go back to fun. And he said the magic words. He said, well, you know, Carson, toys are fun. I said, Gene, you would hire me at Mattel? He said, are you kidding me? I'd hire you in a heartbeat. All that technology stuff, you know, we need to bring that into Mattel to get products in the market sooner, because a lot of what we work with is Disney Entertainment, which is movie-based, and we get very short development schedules. If we can develop the products sooner, we can develop them better, or we can develop more of them, and we can make more money. So I took Gene up on his offer. with the understanding that I would work for the Disney Entertainment Group for a year or 2 years, but when the Hot Wheels job came available, I wanted that job. And so I worked for about a year and a half for Disney Entertainment. We did all the toys, games, puzzles, action figures for Bugs Life, Toy Story, Pocahontas, Lion King, all that stuff. And then,
oh, that's so awesome.
Then sure enough, the Hot Wheels job, which I knew the guy who was doing the job at the time, and I knew from enough scuttlebutt in the industry that he wasn't going to be doing it for long. I was fortunate that Larry Wood, who's Mr. Hot Wheels, has been there 40 years, recently retired. He's the guy who designed more Hot Wheels cars than anyone else. Him and four other guys, which later became my staff, went into my new big boss and said, there's a guy over at Disney Entertainment. We want him to be our boss. So I got recruited to work to have be Larry Wood's boss, which I still tease him about. I mean, Larry Wood is Mr. Hot Wheels. If anybody knows Larry Wood and Hot Wheels, he's the man.
And one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet.
And I will tell you that I use Larry as an example when I talk to students about the business of design or the design business, which is a play on words, but Larry has always been in the design business. He rejected every promotion that included a management title for him. All he wanted to do was design. And that's why that guy lasted there 40 years.
Right.
Anybody else who got promoted up the pathway to be supervisor, manager, vice president, pretty soon you're not designing anymore. You're managing resources, people. You lose that creativity, and you kind of hit that Peter principle. You hit your level of ineffectiveness. Larry knew that early on. And then there are people like me that really I use design as a business tool. I'm on the other side of things. I'd still do some design work, but Larry, you know, built his career. So I learned a lot from Larry, but I was thrilled when they recruited me to have that job. So I took over Hot Wheels design. Then I ran an engineering, then I ran licensing for them.
I'm tired just thinking about all you.
Well, the licensing thing is, I got to tell you the licensing story because it just came up the other day for they did the 50th anniversary Hot Wheels kickoff party at the Mattel Design Center there in El Segundo. And they did a Hot Wheels Legends get together. And Lord knows, I don't know how I got in that Legends group, but they had me there.
Oh, come on.
But they told the story of the Twin Mill, the two-engine car that had been started at Boyd's shop, and Boyd's went bankrupt. We got a call from Chip that said, come get this car before the bank takes it, because there's no VIN number, there's no registration, and the bank's just going to seize assets. So they went over, put it on a flatbed. We got it out of there. When I had moved from Disney Entertainment to Hot Wheels, John Handy was my boss. He was the senior vice president of Boys Toys. I did the interview, and he said, the job is yours. I want you to run this division for me. Are there any questions? I said, yeah, John. What happened to the Twin Mill? Why is it sitting in the back of our building for a year and a half under a tarp just rusting away? And he said, God, why would you screw up a perfectly good interview? And I said, well, John, that car's our history. It's the first car that was uniquely designed as a Hot Wheels car, not a Barracuda, not a Camaro, an OEM car, but designed by Ira Guilford. It's really given credit as the first original Hot Wheels car. It's our history. It's a living embodiment of speed, power, performance, and attitude. It shows we're the world's coolest car company. He goes, oh, you got plenty of passion. I said, yeah, we need to build that car. We need to tour that car. He goes, it's your project.
Oh.
I said, okay. Nice. I said, well, can I look at my line item budget? Or how am I going to fund it? He goes, oh, you don't have a budget, but you got lots of passion. You'll figure out a way to get it done. Slide. Wait, this is can we cuss on this channel? That's referred to
yes,
as
you can. In,
that is referred to as slipping in your own shit. So I slipped in my own shit on that one. So I got really creative. I called Bob Larravee Jr., who was a great guy and has since passed away from Championship Auto Shows. I said, Bob, you tour show cars and you pay people for show cars. If you will fund the completion of this car, I will give it to you for 3 years, and I also will give you 20 to 50,000 units of cars every year that are the Twin Mill that you can sell for $20 a piece and make the money back. Will you do that? Because I could get cars made for free. I had cars. I didn't have money. So it was the ultimate barter. And Bob said, I'll do it.
Wow.
I shipped the car to Bob. Bob sent it to Karen Industries. Barry Lobeck did the canopy and the exhaust. He went back to Karen Industries, which was a prototype builder. We put it on tour. We unveiled it at SEMA. But I didn't want to just be the toy car company that showed up at SEMA like we were all that. I wanted to play under the moniker of Hot Wheels is the world's coolest car company. Little tongue-in-cheek. We knew it'd be a stretch for a toy company to be at SEMA. I mean, come on, you're a toy company. Right. Yeah, the only credibility we had was early days with Petty, which we still had, and Snake and Mongoose. But those were kind of over. Petty was still running, but Snake and Mongoose were long gone. But I said, look, John, if we take the car there, I don't want to just plop this car down in the middle of a booth and sell toys. I want to present it as we're the world's coolest car company. He goes, what do you think? And I said, well, we have 92 designers on staff. Give me them for 1 week, and I want them to design any product they think Hot Wheels would make if we were a car company. He goes, I don't understand where you're going. I said, look, this is lifestyle marketing. This is creating demand for the image of the business, not the product from the business. So my crew, we did wheels, tires, tools, paint, car wax, rollaway boxes, clothing, everything as if it was branded Hot Wheels. Then I went further and said, I want to make prototypes of this. So I got people to make shirts. I had car wax packaging done. I made full-scale wheels. And I put all this stuff on display at SEMA as if we were the world's coolest car company. We were the hit of that damn show.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
I took the car down the streets in Vegas because I insisted everybody know it's a driving car, which is another funny story. Later, I'll tell you about the two policemen I passed. Anyway, we unveiled the car, and all of a sudden, my buddies in the wheel business are coming up saying, dude, what are you sandbagging me? When did you guys start making wheels? We would make those. Those are just prototypes. I'll license that to design right now. Then Mother's Car Wax comes over and said, when did you start making wax? Why aren't you telling me this, Carson? Those are mock-ups. We'll license that. Then BC Ethic makes clothes, and then PPG makes paint. So at the end of the day, I call back to the corporate office, and I talk to the president of the unit. I said, I need to get a licensing attorney out here to write contracts. I said, look, all I know is that I have four companies that are trying to shove dollars in our pockets. So I said, fly the attorney out on my budget. I'll figure it out later. So they flew the attorney out. In those 4 days at SEMA, I call it my four cubed. In those 4 days at SEMA, we signed four agreements that equated to $4 million in first year sales.
Oh, my gosh.
After SEMA, brought the car in. And if you can see all this on the Rides TV show, the documentary, they talked about the twin mill, and they later talked about the DR2. They showed us driving it down the street and all that. And it was a cultural hit. I mean, it was, you know, any of us would rather drive a Hot Wheels car than the most badass
Hot Wheel,
Bosch or whatever car. I'd rather drive a Hot Wheels. And so I knew that there was something there. So I get back in town on Monday after SEMA, and I get this kind of call slip. Like when you're bad in high school, you get a call slip to go to the principal's office, you know? I get this note to go see Matt Busquette, who's the president of the unit. He goes, hey, great job. You now run licensing. Shit, Matt, I don't know anything about licensing. He goes, you know what we're doing 4 days and anybody's done around here in 4 years. So I took over licensing. So, and then that became, well, now here's the funny story going back to medicine. I didn't realize I was doing licensing in medicine when we did that CT scanner. After it had been in the market about 2-3 years, we were doing our next version of it, which would be a full body scanner. There was a lot of demand for that. Toshiba came to us and said, look, if you're not going to manufacture that anymore, we would like to manufacture that and sell it only in Japan. My boss came to me and said, look, Carson, here's the head of Toshiba. He was here last week. They want to license our design and the rights to manufacture only in Japan, write a licensing contract. And I said the same thing I said to them at Hot Wheels years later. I don't know anything. He said, look, here's the deal. Licensing comes from protecting and expanding and exploiting your intellectual property. Most of the design on that CT scanner came from you and your group. Write a contract that protects you and it'll protect us. And I went, wow. And I learned a lot about Japanese culture and presentation and how we're cowboys and want to, you know, do the deal and then drink and party, and how they want to drink and do the deal and then party later. You know, I learned a lot about American and Japanese culture and why you don't put soy sauce on rice and don't store me, all kinds of great stories. anyway, learned a lot, but I didn't realize I was learning licensing. So I reverted back to my licensing practices that I had in the medical field that are very linear, very stringent, very regulatory based. Well, toys aren't. And I started doing licensing. Started doing more and more work, started doing TV shows, and ended up being kind of the talking head for Hot Wheels brand, because marketing would make presentations and they would make things that were incorrect by dates or incorrect by, you know, calling cars like a Ford Mustang. They call it a Ford Corvair. No, guys, that's wrong. And so eventually they would have me read their notes, and then eventually I started doing presentations. Anyway, I started doing the TV shows like Popular Hot Rodding, Stacy David's TV show, Cam Evans, Hot Rod TV, My Classic Car, like a reoccurring role talking about Hot Wheels. So I did a bunch of TV. Chip got his TV deal going. And then next thing you know, I decided, well, I'm going to leave Hot Wheels. I'm gonna start my own gig. I'm going to start Redfin, and I'll build it up from Chip, and I'll just take another jump through another career hoop.
Yeah, and, you know, why not, right? You know, it's like the stone that keeps on rolling, and it's neat to see how you've put all these pieces together and just made this really neat career out of. It's just too cool.
Well, I mean, a lot of it, like I said in the opening, I believe this, is that I really am the sum total, 99% really, of all the people that mentored me, gave me guidance, taught me things, gave me encouragement, you know, right. corrected me when I needed it, but gave me good advice at the right time. And then it just, you know, I've wandered through this career doing different things. I couldn't have planned it like this. My son works in the business with me. That's another funny anecdotal story. He's a finance marketing guy. When I had compression engineering, he was in high school and he ran the back room where files came in. And remember the old days when FTP sites were better than the web? And you could log into an FTP site, it was secure and you could send files and nobody could get anything. You didn't have to encrypt codes. Well, he ran the back room on weekends. He was in school. He was a scholar athlete, played basketball, volleyball, a great student. And so on weekends, he would go in, open up the computers, bring down all the files, send these files to CNC, send those files to rapid prototyping, send those files. So he loaded work. So when the guys came in on Monday, they just turned on the computer, downloaded the files. Well, there's my work for the week. That's what Aaron did. So he's a techie kid. He was at Long Beach State, my alma mater. He first went to UCLA and later transferred to Long Beach State. Needed to do a summer intern. And I said, well, I got a friend of Mattel who runs finance. Maybe we can get you into accounting. He did an interview. And they said, well, the only opening we have is in royalty accounting, where you count and audit and accumulate royalties for Hot Wheels and royalties going inbound and outbound, meaning when we license our name outward or when people license your Hot Wheels name for other products. It's a junior position, and we'll let you do this for 3 months during the summer. 6 years later, he was still working there. Jeez. He knew how to write shell scripts and how to write algorithms for coding and looked at their computer system and couldn't understand why you went to one computer and printed it out and went to another computer across the room and entered those numbers into another computer before you could do your work. He's like, well, those two computers are on the same network, right? Yeah, but that one's an AS400 and that one's a blah, blah, blah. And he goes, well, you can write script that, well, when that file comes up, tells it what to do. Well, we don't know how to do that. He said, well, when I get done with the interview, I'll show you. So the kid's way smarter than me. So anyway, he was there 6 years. He did a lot of stuff. And in 4 years into his 6 years is when I took over licensing. So I'm working with him almost on a daily basis. And so we were driving back and forth to work. We carpooled together, you know, and we got to talking. Chip's business started getting big. Chip needed help to run his business. Chip had made an overture to me to run it. And my son was the first one to say is, why don't we start our own business? You know, you've seen enough of licensing. You've seen enough of business. I know the financials. I know the algorithms. I know how to write code. I know how to write contracts. I know what Mattel does. I've seen all the biggest contracts. Why don't we start our own thing? That was 13 years ago.
Wow.
And it's fun. We don't do the Paul Tuttle and senior and junior and throw wrenches or drop bad bombs. We have lively debates. We have discussions, but we've always
you
had
don't
this
punch him when he pisses you off, you know?
Oh, no. He's
Mickey
6 foot,
Thompson him?
He's 6 foot three and about 240. I don't go anywhere
he's
near
a
punch
big guy, man.
He's a big boy. Yeah. He's an athlete. He's a big guy. He's pretty beefy. But we've always kind of had the rule that, look, as this business grows, there are things that are my core competencies, his core competencies. If it falls in between, we have to figure out, well, who logically should do it by skill set or interest. And then you do it. And I was mentioning too this Gene Inslee guy who brought me to Mattel, and I'm just going to see him next week for lunch. I just got reconnected with him. I follow his rule of how you give projects to people. When you give a project to a person, you do one of two things. You tell them exactly or in linear fashion exactly what you want done, or you tell them, here's what I want done, figure out how to get it done. You don't mix it up.
Right.
And so he and I do that. If I give him something to do and I need it done a certain specific way, I'll say, take notes on this. Here's exactly how I want it done. And he'll do it. Or I'll say, here's what I'm thinking. What are you thinking? Now, recently, what's happened is he's really running more of the day-to-day. We're on an acquisition mode right now where he's acquiring more shares in the business for in the next few years. He'll be running it outright, and I'll be the employee, and he'll be the CEO. And that's fine with me. Mm-hmm. It's part of the transition. But really, right now, I get as much day-to-day instructions of what we need to do from him as I do on my own. And I'm fine with that. It doesn't bother me at all because the worst time to teach him how to run this business is when I'm dead or gone or he has to. The best time to teach somebody is when you're still around.
Right.
So, and you probably heard me. I think Brad's heard me say this. My silly metaphor that I make is if this was Kentucky Fried Chicken, eventually I just want to show up in a white suit. I don't want to cook. I don't want to sell. I don't want to raise chickens. I just want to be a guy who shows up in a white suit. That's my role.
Nice.
So, but yeah, we're fortunate. We've had, you know, good growth and a lot of cool opportunities, and we've got some new opportunities in the music segment that we'll talk about later that have just come in our lap. This Mario Andretti thing, we're vetting through that. The NBC Universal thing is great because we've been with them since movie 3. Chip's business is always, you know, what a wonderful guy to work with there. You know, Ralph at RMD Garage, Chris Jacobs, you know, was the host of Barrett Jackson Overhauling. He's a client of ours. And then we do a lot of consulting. We do a lot of specific project-based consulting, which is kind of fun.
Speaking for the group using the consulting thing, I have to say thank you because we've consulted with you a lot. Well, I got to call Carson. I don't know what we're doing here.
Hey, it's always nice to get a call. I mean, let's face it. Everybody likes getting a call that says, hey, I need help. It's like, Brad, I'm doing this lettering. I need help. You know, you know, I'm using this gold size. It's not kicking off right. What am I doing wrong? Can I engine spin synthetic aluminum, or does it have to be, you know, silver gold? You know, like, can I engine spin variegated? What should I be clearing it with? Bounce bar? What should I, you know, so I'm doing a table.
We've had lots of conversations.
Yeah, it's the same thing to you.
It's funny, we covered so much, but yet it feels like talking to you, we've only, like, for lack of a better word, we barely chipped into the iceberg.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of other fun stuff, like the Disney Pixar thing that Brad was involved in with us, how that came down,
project
was just, that literally was probably the greatest reunion of talent and the semblance of talent in that specific field that I've ever been involved in. That was just so much damn fun. The people, the process, the product. I mean, everything about that was just one of those things. I mean, Brad, you may agree. I felt bad when it was over. I wanted to keep working. I wanted to keep doing stuff.
Yes, that was my meeting with you. We first actually met. It's like, you look, because you knew Jeff, you knew Dennis, but we had never met. So you didn't know anything about me. One of the first things I did was the lettering in that store. You know, Chip's like, hey, go letter that and do this. And it's like, all right. You know, so, you know, he already knew what I could do, but you didn't know what I was. So you walked in, you went, you're a lettering guy? Yeah, sort of, most of the time. Why? Well, that's what I did. I did that. Well, then next time you brought your portfolio in, it's like, holy crap, Carson's awesome. This wasn't what I was expecting here. I figured that he's like a snake oil salesman, but no, this guy's like awesome.
He's a snake oil salesman who can also letter. What's funny, because I'm more on the contract side, and like I said, my career was built on the business side of design. I use design as a business tool. Chip uses it as a design tool. He expresses things and creates things, and they're emotional. And I use those things for business reasons. And so a lot of people think, oh, he's just a contract guy. He's an agent. He's a manager. Well, that's okay. I mean, honestly, sometimes it's good when people don't realize the other things you do, you know, in a way.
The Disney thing was awesome. We had lots of great conversations. I talked to you a bunch. Got to talk to Chip. Just, you know, when you're stuck next to each other, you got nothing else better to do but talk.
Yeah. So, and I have a really deep connection with Disney with my dad, who passed away early, who had friends who worked at Disney. A couple of his friends were the original 9 old men. One he went to high school with, and one was in a bulldog club my dad started. And so when I was a kid, with my mom being a single mom, she would save all her pennies during the year. Well, I'll put it to you this way. When my dad died, I was 3.5 years old. My oldest brother was 7. My mom had 4 kids under 7. Had a brand new house they had just moved into when I was born, a brand new car. My mom had $38 in the checking account and had not worked in 10 years. So my mom had to pull it together. And I will tell you, beyond all the people of Mickey Thompson and Ed Iskenderian and Ollie Parks, I learned more about life from my mom than anybody else. She's 94 years old, just little old Texas lady who didn't know anything but to just run as fast as you can and do as much as you can. Man, I love her to death, and she's like my hero. But the deal was, she would save all year to be able to go to Disneyland. If we didn't go to Disneyland in the summer, we were smart enough as kids to not expect anything at Christmas, because there were some tough years. But when we went to Disneyland, we went there to celebrate my dad's dreams, because my dad always wanted to work there. He had friends who worked there and kept saying, Paul, you got to work here, you got to work here. But he couldn't get away from a family business. And it ends up being kind of the reason, we'll save that story for later, why my dad didn't live further. So we went to Disneyland to celebrate my dad as much as celebrate my mom getting us through another year. So it had a lot of emotional stuff to me at Disneyland, and it still does. And so the fact that I got to work on something at Disneyland was, I don't want to say I'm living out my dad's dream or something like that, but it was a reconnection. And then another connection for me in Disneyland is when I was coaching gymnastics when I was at Lakewood High School, and in college I coached gymnastics as one of my three part-time jobs. We had a kid named Scott Moss, whose sister was in my gymnastic program, who was a really good competitive athlete. Well, Scott had the misfortune on his 9th birthday of being hit by a car and thrown 60 feet in the air. Ooh. And broke all major bones in his body and compound fractures and broke his spine and legs. Anyway, the mom and dad came to me and said, look, you know, you've got our daughter in your competitive program. Can we put Scott in a program here with you to build him back up in rehabilitation? I said, we're not a rehabilitation program. We're a competitive program. In fact, these kids, if they don't make progress, they don't stay in the program. So I said, don't sign him up. And I only knew him from when his sister was dropped off. I said, don't sign him up. I teach 4 nights a week, two classes every night. Have him just follow me and shadow me. Just have him follow me around. When we climb the rope, he'll climb the rope. When we bounce on the trampoline, he'll bounce a trampoline. And so we would do stretches and warm-ups and strength exercises. And then eventually he started walking better. His coordination came back. Within a year, he was walking without a limp and a gait. And his spine got in a back brace. And, you know, he was always in some kind of crazy brace. Anyway, he made a full and complete recovery. Well, I get married to my wife. We buy a house in Lakewood. I'm in the garage, let her in a race boat one time, and here comes this kid down on the bike who's now 14, 15 years old. It's Scott Moss. He lives down the street from me. And he says, you know, dude, you remember? I said, yeah, Scott, what are you doing? He says, well, I race motorcycles now. I've made a full recovery, you know, and all these things for me. Well, Scott was interested in sign painting. I didn't know you did this. Oh, my gosh, I've always wanted to learn it. So I did a different version of what Kenny Youngblood did for me. I said, well, here's the brushes. Here's the ones you use for water, you know, sables for watercolors and posters. Here's the ones I use silkscreen ink when I make banners for paper windows. Here's when I do trucks. I use lettering quills. I use oil base. I do the airbrushing. Here's gold leaf. Here's how you seal it. You know, here's the whole thing. I did the same thing that Kenny did with me here. Wash out my brushes and clean my brushes, and I'll teach you something. Go get me a hamburger. And damn if he didn't keep coming back and coming back and coming back. Well,
be like, hey, stand over in that corner. Do you have a car?
For 3 days, yeah. Yeah. And so he got so good, I started taking him with me on jobs, not as a helper, but as a painter. I used to do a lot of gyms back in the day, the outside exteriors and the floor graphics. I did a ton of those. And he was always there for me, helping me on those jobs. So eventually he applied to Art Center. He graduated from Art Center. He worked for American Honda for a while in their race team. And then he got a job with Disney Imagineering. And now today, Scott is the principal graphic designer at Disneyland.
Wow.
Anything that's wayfinding, dude, signage is Scott Moss. And God bless him. He gives me credit for getting him started, but he did it on his own. I just gave him a little nudge. But having that connection to Disneyland is profound for me, too, because about every 2 months we'll get together. Every 2-3 months we'll get together early in the morning. I'll meet him at his office, which used to be in the park. Now it's off the park because they did the Star Wars thing. And I'd meet him at 5 o'clock, and we would ride bikes through the park. He would point out the projects he's working on, and then we'd get lunch or breakfast, and then I'd leave at about 7 or 8 before the park opened. And so being there after hours when it's quiet and people are putting out plants and they're painting and touching up and they're steaming off the streets and they're doing ride maintenance and stuff is this cool little bonding thing. And I call him a kid. Scott's probably 52, 53. So, but he's a kid to me. But so I have that connection. So when we did the Cars Land thing, he was over on set a lot. And I think I introduced him to Brad, but it's just, you know, I have a deep connection with Disney. So doing everything in Cars Land was really, really rewarding in a lot of ways for me, in a lot of ways.
There's nothing you haven't had your hands on. Is there? I mean, space program, maybe?
Well, here's a funny thing. When I worked in the medical field, I worked for a company between the blood handling group, a company called Delmar Avionics. Delmar was famous for inventing the Holter monitor, the little device you wear on your hip that has a 12-lead EKG that records your heart in a 12 or 24-hour period and then looks for anomalies. Now it's all done digitally. We invented that, and so we did all the astronaut monitoring for EEG, which is electroencephalograph brainwave, EKG. Oh, I'm sorry, EKG is electrocardiogram. Is blood pressure. We had 4 monitoring systems on spatial astronauts. I designed the treadmill that the astronauts used in space to maintain bone density, because we found out that gravity aggravates the epithelial lining of the bone and causes muscle contraction, and elongation is suppressed because you have gravity irritating like a oyster creates a pearl. Well, when you take away gravity,
of course, we all knew that.
Well, when you take away gravity, you lose bone density, and they come back with fragile bones and bones that are less porous and bones that are more brittle. And so we invented a treadmill, and we also did four station monitoring. I had equipment on all the shuttle flights, and we had information that showed downlink information that some of the astronauts actually had signals still being emitted from devices after the Challenger explosion. They were not viable. It'd be like being in a really bad car accident, but we still had data that showed that astronauts were not killed at the point of explosion, that astronauts were not viable, but were still emitting signals and signal data. That was an interesting day when they came in and right after the accident, after the explosion, and came in and locked up our rooms.
You know, we all had. I just read an article about that yesterday. Well, yeah, what are the chances? Sorry, continue.
Anyway, I them. I also, at one point, funny enough, the Civilian in Space program was started by Ronald Reagan. And the initial gist of it was to try to get creative people to go up in space and look at it from a non-linear engineering, but look at it from a lateral creative process. Well, because I'm right brain, left brain, I had an appreciation. I have an engineering background and I have a design degree. I have an understanding for the need of discipline from, you know, science and medicine. I was trained that way. But because I'm an artist and a designer, I look at things opportunistically and laterally, meaning going from A to Z, back to M, over to O, over to T, where linear is, you know, A, B, C, D, following a path. So I wrote a proposal to be a civilian observer. From 150,000 applicants, it went down to 88. I made the cut. From 88, it went down to 50. I made the cut. From 50, it went to 25,000. I made the cut. Then I got to go to the space camp interviews and do all that stuff. And then that was the year that Ronald Reagan was in real trouble with teachers and had not paid attention to teachers, and they changed the program to teacher-based program. So all of our applications were thrown out.
And but Sally in a way, that's got the right thing.
Because, you know, McAuliffe was the teacher who was killed in that, you know, but we got to go to, the cool thing is we got to go to shuttle launches. I got to go to shuttle landings. I got to take my kids to them. I got to work with an astronaut. Dr. William Thornton was an astronaut and a physicist. I got to work with him. And so, yeah, I worked within the NASA space program. What's really fun is I just found this out about 2 years ago, that equipment I designed in that program for Del Mar is actually on permanent display at the Smithsonian. I'm like, I need to go take a picture of that.
So
that was pretty cool. I mean, that was, so this is kind of the Forrest Gump thing. You know, I've been just, I do enough goofy things that, you know, I have a lot of fun. I couldn't have planned this out, you know. And then, you know, being involved in the Snake and Mongoose movie, you know, we were there for that last drag race. And then again, I started there and then circle back later. I get to be in the movie and play the track announcer, Steve Evans. And it was like a reunion going up there to watch the filming of that. Being involved with Snake and Mongoose was a treat, doing it with Hot Wheels. So I'm fortunate a lot of things that were fun and important to me as a kid, I still get to do now. I've never really had to grow up. I look at it and I go, holy moly, who would have ever thought it would come back? I mean, not that I'm the greatest guy in the world doing things, but I get to work with some really cool brands. I've been entrusted with some really cool work of people that, you know, I really trust and really like working with. And I get to do some fun stuff. And I get to meet people. I mean, had it not been for me working with Chip and doing Disney, I wouldn't have met Brad. We wouldn't be talking now.
That's
so
true.
That's a plus.
Well, I don't know if it's a plus, but it happened.
Well, I'll take it as a plus. You may think that I'm on the necklace.
No, you're a plus. You're getting the bad end of the deal. I'm.
it's a plus for all of us. Yeah, you know, I think in our own way.
I think so.
So yeah, you know, I just try to scale it that way. You know, I try to make sure that, you know, I'm always being painfully honest with myself.
No, what's wrong with that?
We get some fun stuff to do. We get some great blessings, you know. We get some, you know, fun things that come our way. And, you know, some of them are challenging and some of them are invigorating and some of them are rewarding and most of them are fun.
Ben, this has been so much fun.
I think I've dragged you through the weeds just like we did last time.
Nope, not at all.
No, this is a whole new drag through the weeds. I mean,
it's a whole new bunch of weeds.
It's better weeds. That's right.
Different field.
This was incredible. I can't thank you enough for sharing what you did and being as candid as you were with some pretty personal stuff, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, my pleasure. Well, we'll just use this to plant seeds should things come up in the future. And if you ever need me to guest host again, if there's any of that stuff or points
heck
of
yes, we do.
History or whatever. I mean, gosh, we've covered enough that we'll just consider that kind of like an overview. And if you want to delve down on any of these things from, you know, drag racing in the old days to where it is now, corporate sponsorship, technologies, why computers have created a great execution of bad design, you know, from the technology side, from teaching millennials in school to anything you want to, even down to pinstriping tips from Brad. We could probably cover most of it.
Nice.
Well, next time we'll talk about Don Prudhomme and Tom McEwen and the tricks they played on me at Lions Drag Strip, how I earned my keep with those two, and then bringing them back to Hot Wheels and doing stuff with them. And then some of the Ed Ross stories were pretty funny, too, and even some of the stuff with Kenny Youngblood and some of the Hot Wheels stuff that we did. The story of the unveiling of the twin mill at SEMA and the two policemen. I think a guy just posted that story up the other day. I did an interview at the 50th anniversary.
And I was reading that.
Yeah, kind of funny. Yeah, that was kind of a fun day.
That was awesome. But man. Yeah, so I'll have to come up with, you know, we'll try to come up with an industry you have not been involved with. And that'd be a better
one.
I'm not
going to say anything because I know he has.
Eric, we'll just stump Carson.
I think you've just about hit it all. I think I have a narrow bandwidth but deep saturation. So that's the way. It's funny. That's the way I describe my automotive brand management company. We only work in the automotive segment. We are narrow bandwidth. I mean, we only work in automotive, but we do a lot of stuff within automotive, from licensing, endorsement, sponsorships, representation, you know, agreements, you know, licensing, all kinds of stuff. But yeah, it's kind of funny. So I'd like to say it's all by design, but really there's no way I could have, I mean, this job didn't exist 20 years ago, 25 right. years ago. There, you know, this kind of what I'm doing didn't exist. You know, I appreciate the time and the opportunity to vent and kind of pay respects to, you know, which is important to me, you know, but, you know, it's you know, for the guys who helped me. I mean, I want to give the proper recognition to those guys and name them by name when I can. Some of them are still around, some are not, but you know, my point being that everybody at some time in their life needs help, needs a little nudge, needs a little guidance, needs something, and sometimes it makes all the difference. And I keep saying I'm the sum total of that. So, you know, I think, you know, it's a great gift that's, you know, given that it is only good if you keep giving. It's like knowledge. Knowledge, if you hold on to it, is nothing. It's only if you share it that it has value.
Right.
So if you're the smartest guy in the room, but you won't tell anybody anything, you might as well be, you know, a rock.
Let me let you get to your evening then, because, I mean, you know, you've had a busy day, and we will definitely pick this back up. I'm looking forward to it.
Well, man, I really appreciate you guys indulging me. I know I can, I know I can go on and on. What do they say? There's the Alcoholics Anonymous, there's Al-Anon, and then there's on and on and on. So I think I need to join the support group on and on and on. Only because I'm passionate and I want to make sure that people understand, you know, everybody needs help. Everybody gets help somewhere, and that, you know, all of us should be mentoring more. That, you know, there's a lot of guidance and there's a lot of needy people for various reasons, and that's, we'll talk about that later. But it's frustrating to me that people don't really help a lot of other people anymore, and they consider what they're doing to be exclusive to them and not inclusive to everyone, and they protect it and hold it and guide it like it's, you know, secret formulas. And it's like, I don't get that, but you know, I'm blessed, and so I get passionate, and then everything to me has got a story or an anecdote on it, no matter what it is. So sorry.
Well, that's good though. Oh. No, and that's kind of the whole point of our podcast anyway. We want to hear these stories, and I think are important to, you know, have out there.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to throw in when I can.
Oh man, you more than threw in. You.
Makes me want to come hang out with Carson. We ought to do a round six day at Carson's house or something.
Come on over. I have two rooms full of, like, gas pumps and candy machines and neon signs and Hot Wheels and just skateboards and Coke machines and just kind of, like, you know, all the stuff that just is, like, juvenile and silly and serves no purpose.
Perfect.
It makes me smile. You know?
That's why you have two rooms full of it.
Yeah.
It makes no sense.
Well, one's in the office. My wife, last, we actually get work done in here. And the other one is the bonus room. So she actually went up there one time and said, what day did I actually lose control of this? Probably the day we moved in. So, it's funny because I tease her all the time that, look, you know, I don't do drugs. I don't drink. I don't chase women. I don't gamble. I don't do silly things. If I give up cars and all this stuff, what are those five things do I get to do? Because all this energy's got to go somewhere. All of a sudden, this seems better. This seems okay. Sort of.
Well, wonderful. Well, thank you, sir.
Thanks for letting me be a part of this. I appreciate it, guys.
Thank you very much, Carson.
Thank you.
Glad we finally pulled it off.
Us too, and you didn't have to sing or dance. So
even better. Okay, my pleasure, guys.
Thanks again, Carson.
Thank you. All right, guys, have a good evening.
You do the same. Thanks.
All right, take care. Good night.
Bye. Bye. We'll have we'll obviously have notes on the site from the podcast here. We'll have some photos, things to kind of bring you guys up to speed, a couple links to the show, other things you can learn more. And as always, at the end of the episode, I have remained Brian.
I'm still Brad.
I'm still Alex.
And I think I'm still Eric.
And hey, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you guys on the next episode. Thanks again for listening, and be sure to keep up with us gearheads over on our website at www.roundsixpod.com. And if you'd like to, be sure to follow along with us over on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.
I think you guys have unique attributes of the way you do it, the base of the four of you guys, and what you cover and your perspective. And then where you're going from the passion side. I think that's the purity of why this is why it's easy for me to give you guys any help I can. I'm in total alignment with those things you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
Take that compliment.